Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing award-winning Australian fantasy novelist Dr. Tansy Rayner-Roberts. Welcome to the podcast, Tansy, or should I say welcome back, but this time to the other side of the mic.
Absolutely. Hi, Sean. It's nice to be back and not to be in charge.
I can imagine that, knowing all the pain that you have to go through in post-production. But first questions, first up, congratulations on your winning the Hugo for Best Fan Writer.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you, how does it feel? And if you can answer that without just one big long squee, that'd be really great.
It feels very strange, really. I mean, the whole thing, not having been at the ceremony myself, there is that strange thing of it does feel a little bit like it happened to somebody else because of the remoteness of it. You know, I got to watch the ceremony a little bit on the stream. I actually did get to watch the whole bit about my category before it all collapsed in a heap and I wasn't able to see much of it. So, yeah, it is very strange. It does feel a little bit – it was very exciting on the day. And I'm sure it's lovely. But I was a bit overwhelmed by the whole thing. And
as you should be. Yeah.
Yeah, I was a little bit glad not to be there in one way because I think it would have just been a little bit too terrifying. You know, I've got up in award ceremonies before, but the whole Hugo thing, I think I would have been quite tempted just to go under my seat and not come out, which, you know, would be very embarrassing. So instead, the lovely Deb Stanish went up and was very eloquent on my behalf and wore a brilliant dress. So, you know, it was a very nice way to go through it. But now, of course, I've got to wait for the postal system to send me my Hugo, and then I think it will really feel real when it arrives. I don't know, like postal stuff between here and the US, it's not quite as bad as postal between here and Perth, but I imagine it's almost as bad. So it could be months. I don't know.
Well, I was going to follow on from that with, you know, you've won what's a considerably, impressive award for anybody in science fiction and fantasy. For your actual non-fiction writing, what does that mean for you now? Is that added pressure or...?
I don't know. It is an odd sort of thing. I've won other awards for my fan writing as well, like in Australia, I've won the fan writer for Dithmar and the Athling. But, yeah, I don't know. It's an odd sort of thing, isn't it? Because it's for the work that I don't get paid for, which in some ways it's much nicer to get an award for that because you don't actually get any other real reward. I mean, I suppose technically, you know, the idea is that you write lots of interesting things in your blog, people come and read them and enjoy them, and they might eventually buy your books as well. Generally speaking, I find people who really enjoy reading the stuff on my blog, it doesn't necessarily translate to book sales. And the whole thing becomes quite self-sustaining, like it's quite easy to spend all my writing time, and I have very limited writing time, it's quite easy to spend all of it just writing about superheroes and Doctor Who, because that's less pressury. Yeah, I don't know, in some ways there's a feel, though, does that mean that everything I have to write from now on needs to be award-winning? I refer you to the previous comment about going under the chair and not wanting to come out. So I don't know. I suppose in some ways it's not like I can achieve any more in a way with my fan writing, so maybe it's time to do a bit less of that and write more novels. I don't know. I enjoy it. I take great pleasure of it. It's extraordinarily nice to hear, to have people reading it and have people reading it so widely. I think having been in the Hugo packet probably, you know, suddenly all these people read my work that hadn't previously been to my blog or read it. And, it's very touching. And getting to see the stats, of course, after the awards went out, as you've got to go straight to the stats and find out all things. I found it really fascinating as a Hugo observer as well as participant, because, of course, I wear many hats. I found it really interesting that I had the least amount of nominations going in, which meant I basically just scraped onto the ballot, and then I won, which is really strange. It's an odd sort of feeling, but it does mean, I assume, that an awful lot of people who voted for me had never heard of me before I was on the ballot. So, you know, that's nice. It suggests they actually like the work. That's really cool.
No, and being a follower of your blog as a follower of your writing, I can understand why they would make that perfectly correct decision to vote you for the Hugo. I was going to say there's always a bit of an argy bargy when it comes to authors or pro writers winning in a fan category, and I was wanting to ask you, what do you think we're really celebrating with this category, and does that fan label adequately encapsulate it, do you think?
Yeah, it's an odd one, isn't it? I mean, I think the whole question was asked in a big way with Scalzi, I guess, a few years ago, which was the big example of a very, very popular professional writer then winning a fan award for the blog, and people did question that. I personally feel not particularly guilty about it, largely because I think I have a much bigger audience for my fan writing than I actually have for my professional work, which is in one way very depressing. But I don't know. I mean, I write very actively about fanish stuff, and I think that the writing I do is very fanish. I think it's a bit of a I wouldn't suggest that the category should change. I mean, it's not my awards to say that. I do think that it's a bit of a problem where a lot of people make the distinguish between a lot of people distinguish between fan and pro as to whether you get paid or not. And I don't think that's really enough, because whether you're writing fanishly isn't necessarily, you know, obviously doing it for the love, I get that, you know, that whole thing. And doing it for love usually means not getting paid or being paid a pittance. But, you know, I see brilliant people who write fanish writing, or the kind of criticism that you'd think should be celebrated, something like this. And some of them do occasionally get paid, which is awfully nice, and it shouldn't be discouraged. You know, some people who write for places like Tor.com or, you know, the big magazines, and there isn't really, like, they don't have an Athling. I think we're quite lucky in Australia. We've got the William Athling Award, which is a wonderful award for criticism or review, which allows you to celebrate an individual body or particularly individual piece of work. And they don't have something like that as part of the Hugos, which means there isn't really a way to celebrate, say, the writing essays about pop culture or a lot of things like that if people happen to get paid for it, which feels like a little bit of a gap, I guess. Yeah. And, yeah, so this, I don't know, it's such a wide – I love that the shortlist was made up of people. Like, there were some very traditional fanzine writers in there. There were somebody like Mark Oshiro, who has the most extraordinary kind of cult following. You know, he has massive audience basically following along while he reads stuff and talks about it. I mean, that's fanishness at its truest form. And, you know, I'm pretty sure he has way more blog readers than I do. And, you know, it's fanishness, and that fanishness isn't always brought to the attention of the Hugos, and this year it was, you know, so it was really cool to have a couple of us on there for the first time. Now, there's no easy answer. I mean, no award can cover it. I love writing about fanish stuff personally. I think one of the nicest things I ever said about my blog was Peter Ball, who referred to my blog as a thing of fanish beauty, and that just made me smile for weeks. Because it is, that's the stuff that I love to talk about and analyse and take apart. Having said that, if somebody started paying me to do their writing, I would not say no. I would love to make a living, you know, writing that sort of stuff. But, you know, the opportunities are not always there. And sometimes they are. I mean, some of my favourite things that I've written about Doctor Who in the last couple of years have actually been paid essays. But, yeah, sadly, there isn't necessarily a whole job in that. If it was, I wouldn't be able to do my fiction, and I like to do lots of different things.
As I'm going to get onto in a second, we've sort of been working sort of in tandem with one another for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
I found out some things today even I didn't know. Just looking through your Wikipedia page.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. Hit me.
But you've received accolades for your recent nonfiction work. We've just been talking about that.
Yeah.
But you've had long involvement in what I'd say multiple fandoms or communities, stretches back, I'd say, as far as your professional writing career. Now, I didn't realise that you were a founding member of Andromeda Spaceways In-Flight magazine.
I was. That was such a long time ago now, but yes, I was.
And then I noticed you worked on shared world projects with New Ceres,
yep.
If I'm saying that right. And you're a founding member of Galactic Chat, Galactic Suburbia, and the Verity podcast, all unpaid and what I would consider probably professional level work. You approach all those things professionally. And I wonder what really draws you to that sort of community work, I suppose.
Oh, I'm a sucker, obviously. No, I don't know. I mean, ASIM, to start with, was such an exciting project. And people started talking about it. It came out of the IDA list, which was the first mailing list I ever joined. And I was asked to join it. I think Jonathan Strahan put me onto it within a month or two of me being published and people starting to hear about me. So it was something, me starting to put very tentative steps into the convention community, which I knew nothing about really until the same year that I was published for the first time. Yeah, so it was just the trying to meet people and trying to be part of that. And it wasn't necessarily that it was to forward my writing career, it's just that they happened to happen at the same time because I was 20 when I got published professionally for the first time, and so it was around that time I was finding about all that other stuff. And I didn't really feel like I had a place in the convention-going community until Andromeda Spaceways started up. I think Worldcon, the Australian Worldcon back in, 99, was when I first started meeting people and starting to make connections, but it's hard, especially from Tasmania. You know, you meet people a couple of times, every 2 years. It is very hard to start building that. So I had mailing lists and I'm starting to make a few little friends and stuff, but I found conventions very stressful and awkward, mostly. And then I started actually doing projects with people, and that kind of made it more, it's building a community was just made it all so much nicer. So, like, at that first Worldcon was when I met Chuck McKenzie, and because we were the only people we knew of who'd written spec fic humour, he'd written a science fiction comedy novel and I'd written a fantasy comedy novel, and they came out about the same time. And we sort of knew each other vaguely, and we glommed onto each other at Worldcon and decided to make a book. And at the same time, that was when Kat Sparks was putting a GOG together, I got a press, and I found out about ASIM and started working on that. So by the time it was a convention, I think it was a convergence in 2002, and at that convention we launched ASIM. Australian Absurdities was launched and the first AGOG launch, they were launched at the same time because AGOG ended up printing Australian Absurdities. And suddenly I was part of the community because I knew all these people that I'd been working on stuff with. And it just suddenly it felt like I'd finally cracked it after like 4 years of trying to go to conventions and meet people. So working on things seemed to be a faster way of making friends and being part of the community. And yeah, it's just fun. You know, I love editing. I love the publishing stuff. I only really gave it up because it took so much energy at a time when I was struggling for energy and trying to do too much. And I had to really start concentrating on writing again. And it also filled a bit of a gap because I got published, as I said, really young. I had a couple of novels out and then it all fell in a heap because, you know, it's actually really hard to turn a couple of novel publications into an ongoing career. And that was quite a depressing and demoralizing experience to go through. And so having all this other stuff going on in small press and being part of that, and the pressure was off. It was just such a lovely way to make friends and meet people and still be involved in the stuff I love, and to realise I didn't have to have a novel out every year in order to be part of it. I didn't have to, you know, be hitting those particular milestones, I guess, and that I could participate in ways other than writing fiction, which was quite exciting as well. I never stopped writing fiction, but there was a big chunk of time there where I wasn't getting published, and so coming back into it with short stories and baby steps was it made the whole thing. No, it was friendly, and the community. No, it's like a lot of people say it's a really good idea to sign up to volunteer at a convention the first few times you go, because it's a way to, you know, keeps your hands busy. It gives you a reason to be there. And it really, there's something about the sense of purpose. And I think a lot of people who like science fiction and fantasy also tend to be the kind of people who like to be busy and like to do lots of different things. I don't know what it is. There's something about the work ethic and science fiction and fantasy. Fans, writers, editors, publishers, we all work too hard and we seem to get a great, some sort of soul-filling benefit from overworking across way too many tasks and socialising while we do it.
No, fair enough. I'll come back to that theme you've raised there about communities, because I want to talk about your foray into crime a little bit later on.
Yes.
But with this next question, I introduced you as award-winning, latest being the Hugo.
Yes.
But you started your career basically by winning the inaugural George Turner Prize with, I think it was Splashdance Silver.
Yes, I did.
And I was wondering what was it like to start out on such a high.
Well, it was crazy exciting, and I don't regret it in the least. It was a massive learning curve experience. It was an insane year. It was 1988. I was in my last year of my degree, and it was crazy and exciting and wonderful, and this bolt out of the blue, and I got published, and it was wonderful. However, it's a very high bar to get published at that level and have that level of attention and, I mean, just getting published full stop. But also, I mean, the advance at the time was just probably closer to an average advance then. Advances have gone down. But it was a lot of money all at once. I had a whole year there in which I was actually a professionally paid author. You know, it was also quite a long way to fall because you don't always hit that. You know, I got published. It was very exciting, but it's not always that easy. And of course, it wasn't that easy. It was just, you know, it was just being in the right place at the right time. And I suppose part of me assumed that this was it now, and this was what my job was going to be. And I would write a book every year, and eventually I would be Terry Pratchett. it made some sort of sense at the time. It kept working a bit. I got the second book done because I got a three-book contract as part of the – wasn't as part of the prize, but I did get a three-book contract with them. And the second book, I wrote it really quickly. It got edited. It came out. And that was the point at which things started going a little bit awry, and I started realizing there was just that bit less attention, less interest in me from the publishers. Things had gone very quiet. And then by the time I delivered the third book, it really wasn't what they wanted or expected. Like, they didn't like the third book. They wanted me to completely rewrite it. And that was the first sort of thing. I had no idea how to – like, it took me a year to write a book. And I had no idea what to do, like how to stop and rewrite a book. I'd just got a grant to write a different book. Could I write two books in a year? I didn't know. Now, these days, if I was in that situation, I'd just pull my sleeves up and write two books in a row. But I was – you know, I was very young at the time. I had probably some poor advice, and things just basically kind of fell in a heap, because actually getting published is one step on the ladder, but turning it into a career, like figuring out, you know, you've got to have a lot of luck after another, you've got to have a lot of support, and you've got to be able to pull out the goods. And I was very young. It was very good to have been published that early. I got a lot of opportunities from my 20s that I wouldn't have got if I hadn't got published at the stage that I did. I mean, I was teaching creative writing to, you know, adult students throughout most of my 20s, and that was very useful casual employment. And I would assume they probably wouldn't have given that job to a 22-year-old if she didn't have a couple of novels under her belt. But in my head, I still kind of thought that I should be Terry Pratchett, and that means putting out a book every year and eventually becoming a bestseller. And it didn't seem to be working out very well. And, so It's lovely to get published young, and there are a lot of opportunities that come your way, but they're a lot longer. I don't know. I see a lot of people who get published later in life, and they seem to have much greater resources to turn that into an ongoing career than I had. And everybody's journey is different. But I learned an awful lot from the bumps along the way, which is good because very, very few writers get to be Terry Pratchett. You know, very few writers get to be the one that writes a book and it sells very well and the next book sells better and your career takes off. And I didn't know that at the time. It took me a long time to come to terms with the fact that that actually is not the normal progression for everybody and that most people do have to cope with ups and downs. And, you know, I got on with doing lots of other things and I just kept writing. I never stopped. And I do wonder if I would have kept writing at that degree of faith if I hadn't had that, you know, that support early on, like the idea that, yes, I was publishable. And it's like, okay, well, just because I wrote a book that apparently wasn't publishable doesn't mean that nothing I ever write will be publishable, because obviously a couple of them were. And so I just kept plugging away and plugging away at it and waited for the next opportunities to hit. And as I said with the all the other stuff, like Asim and, you know, the fan stuff and the short story stuff, just kind of kept busy, really. Time went on, more books got written, and,
I was going to jump in there and say, obviously, your writing didn't end there, or we wouldn't be speaking. And,
no, and I got better, which was quite a relief, really.
I was going to say, I looked back over the last 4 or 5 years, which is when I started to notice your writing. Your novella, Siren Beat, which was first published as a double with Rob Sherman's Roadkill, yep. And that was through 12th Planet Press in 2009. That garnered a Washington Science Fiction Small Press Award and I think a Dittmar and Aurealis nominations, and it was on the Locus recommended reading list. I've got two questions about this period.
Okay.
And the first one is very serious. The second one's fanish related. I wondered how important was that support from 12th Planet Press at this stage of your writing?
Oh, it was massively important. I mean, Siren Beat wasn't the first piece I had with them. I think right from the beginning, I was aware of what Elisa was doing. We first met when she set up As If, and I signed on as a reviewer. I'd had a few short stories in her anthologies and things like that. It was, you know, being taken seriously as a writer was very important to me because, as I said, I'd been writing short stories and getting out there, but mostly they'd just been kind of disappearing to a void. It actually took me a lot longer to learn how to write short stories than novels, I have to say. But I do everything backwards. And Siren Beat was, because Siren Beat actually, it wasn't originally commissioned by 12th Planet. It was actually intended for another project that basically, this idea of writing urban fantasy set in Australia. And I was so, it was for a charity project actually that Marianne DePierre had set up. And I'd been working with Marianne for years and I'd been welcomed into the writing group that she set up and things like that. And I was just so excited by the idea of writing something urban fantasy, which at the time was very on trend, I guess, set in Australia. I was like, well, obviously I'd set mine in Hobart. And the story practically wrote itself. It was just crawling over itself to get out of my head. I hit a few bumps along the way, but I got it finished and I was really proud of it. And the project, unfortunately, didn't fund because it was pitched at publishers. There were quite a few big publishers that were interested in it, but then the global financial crisis hit. And suddenly publishers closed their doors to anything that looked remotely difficult, I guess. Anthologies were just... Now, we went from a world in which it was possible to sell on spec an anthology to a publisher to a world in which it wasn't, basically. So the project disappears, which is a shame. And I sent the story to Elisa, and she loved it. And she'd always had this idea of doing the back-to-back novellas by the old sort of vintage science fiction style. And the piece she had from Rob Sherman was because he came out to Australia and ended up, I think, so obsessed by the term roadkill that he heard for the first time in Australia that he had to write this story. And it's not a story set in Australia, but it was inspired by his trip. And so at least he really wanted to put the two together. because she felt they really represented urban fantasy in different ways. Like, mine was much more on the not quite paranormal universe, but definitely the kind of, you know, leather-clad chicks killing monsters kind of side of the genre, whereas Robert's was far more of the contemplative, almost Charles de Lint early, you know, definition of urban fantasy. And that book, as I said, it was a bit of a slow burn. Like, it came out in 2009, as you said. Some of the attention took a while to collect. But it was the first time that a piece of short fiction I'd written really had that level of attention, you know, getting nominated for things and winning the Washington Prize. It made me feel like I was on the right track of something. And it was at a very pivotal point because I had actually just sold, remember the actual time of events, I sold the Creature Court trilogy, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but, you know, I'd sold that to HarperCollins, which was my first novel sale in 8, 9, 10 years. No, probably, well, I signed it 8 years after my previous adult novel had been published. But then we had, like, well over a year before it was going to come out in print. So I signed it really late in 2008. And the first book didn't come out until mid-2010. That was a really long time for me. And so Science Beat kind of came out in the meantime, and it was the point of me starting to feel like, yes, I was a professional writer again. So it was very much part of my renaissance and my this big second phase of my career. So I'm very
fond. Well, I'm actually quite fond of it as well, because I'm pretty sure it's the first work of yours that I ever read, and I thought, you know, for the reasons you were talking about there, it was Australian urban fantasy, almost in a similar vein to Jim Butcher, only I think I prefer your writing to Jim Butcher's, but that same sort of, not quite paranormal, but yeah, certainly, I don't know, I thoroughly enjoyed it, which leads me on to my next question, and I know I've hit you up about this a couple of times, but will we see another Nancy Napoleon novel or novella?
Well, I hope you'll see it, because I was working on it today, and I really like it right now. I actually wrote the Nancy Napoleon novel. I actually got a grant to write it 2 years ago, and I did write it. And it was, I had it critiqued last year, and I was submitting it to agents. But then I had a bit of a, it sounds ridiculous, I had a crisis of confidence, basically. And I got distracted by things, and I blinked, and suddenly a year went past. And I feel utterly ridiculous about it. But I think there was something that I needed to fix about the editing, and I hadn't quite figured it out, and so it had to basically disappear for a while I worked on other things. And I decided just a couple of months ago that I really hadn't given it enough of a chance, and I needed to do more work on it. Never mind the fact that with the grant, this novel, which I love now, I love it this week. So I'm going to actually, I'm really, really close to finishing the edit. I'm about a day away from finishing, and then I'm going to send pictures to queries to as many agents as possible before I lose my attachment for it again. Actually, one of the things, the stoppage that I hadn't realised, was because I was effectively writing it as this is the thing that happens after Siren Beat. So this was like the next adventure of Nancy Napoleon, only it's novel length. The trouble is, because Siren Beat is very strongly, it pretty much exists in two time tracks. It has a very strong flashback quotient that feeds into who the hero is now, and that's just massively important. So when I'm writing the novel, I've now got two layers of flashbacks I've kind of got to bring in, which is the big events where she lost her sister, you know, which has informed who she is. And then the events of Siren Beat 2, you can't not mention. That was a pretty significant, you know, event in her life. And so I had this double layer of flashbacks, and it was just weird. And, of course, what I should have done all along, and I never really accepted that I needed to do, was I needed to fold in Siren Beat to be the first act of the novel. And because it was such a separate story in my head, it took me about a year and a half to come to terms with that. So now I feel ridiculous, but I'm very close to having a publishable novel again, which is nice. So I've actually been working on that really flat, full out on the last couple of weeks, And as I said, I almost could have finished it today, but I did go to afternoon tea instead, which I felt, you know, a social obligation, but I'm hoping to get it finished up before the weekend and send out a bunch of queries, which, you know, as I said, I've got to do it while I'm in love with the book. These things come and go. You go through phases in the editing where you just hate the book, and sometimes that's constructive hate, and sometimes you and the novel need to be separated for a healthy distance. And sometimes you're in love with the book, and that's not healthy either. Like, if you're too in love with it, then you can't, you know, do what needs to be done. So it's a balance, but certainly when it comes to doing scary things like sending queries to agents, it helps to be massively in love with your book. So I'm hoping to harness this particular honeymoon period. And I'm really proud of it. The trouble is, I wrote it thinking not only this is a book that I really want to write, because I did, and it was the novel that so many people asked me about after Siren Beat, and it felt like it was the right time, and there was this sort of boom time for urban fantasy, which was really exciting. I thought, I'm going to do the Australian urban fantasy, it's going to be awesome, and it's all Tasmanian, people don't really set many novels in Tasmania, and I love it to bits. Unfortunately, then I got a lot of negative feedback along the lines of, well, Australian publishers are maybe not that interested because nobody's managed to make urban fantasy really, or very few people have actually made Australian urban fantasy, you know, massively bestseller successful in Australia, which was a bit of a surprise to me because I'm pretty sure that most people I know read a lot of it. And the whole thing, and the Americans maybe won't like it because it's set in Australia. I'm like, nah, it was me thinking I was writing a novel that I really, really liked, but also might actually be a really clever commercial move because urban fantasy was bigger than epic fantasy. And instead what happened while I was writing it was Game of Thrones kind of had its massive second wind, and now epic fantasy is like the bee's knees. And this is why, people, you never write to a trend. There are still plenty of urban fantasy writers out there, so I just have to trust that somebody will like this book and get it out there and work on the next thing. But, yeah, okay. It's been stalled for a bit. I feel very silly about it, but these things happen.
I was going to say, you know that there's at least one person out there waiting for it.
I know. And, you know, that ideally with books, you get more than one person reading.
I know.
Otherwise, it really doesn't work as a business model.
No. Unfortunately. You mentioned there the Creature Court trilogy, and yes. I wanted to ask you, what was it like stepping back into the world of big traditional publishing? What doubts and worries did you have with producing another trilogy?
Well, I didn't really have many in the way of doubts and worries because I was really quite confident in my ability at that stage. Maybe a little overconfident because then I got pregnant, just to make it a little bit trickier. The first book, Power and Majesty, was a really important book to me because that was the book that I was writing. It was the book that I was writing. I'd had it in my head. I'd worked on it really solidly for a year while also finishing up my doctoral thesis. And then I became pregnant the first time. Not the second. This is the first time I was pregnant. And I'd been writing and writing, and I loved it, and I had the vision for the whole series. It was going to be a quartet. And then I got to the crunch of being about 3 months away from my supervisor retiring and my baby coming, and I had to stop writing that novel to finish the thesis before I had my baby. And that was a really big thing for me to especially just lay down the pen and stuff, because I'd always written all through all my academic stuff. I'd always been writing fiction. So to stop writing that novel was a really big deal for me. And then, of course, what happened was I didn't quite finish the thesis before I had the baby. Then I had the baby, and then it took me more than a year to get back to writing fiction. And coming back was like trying to retrain your legs after they've been in plaster for a year. It was really hard. It was one word at a time. And so it felt like it was my comeback novel in many ways. I had a few nibbles. People were really interested in it. And, yeah, the signing that contract was one of the best feelings in the world. I think I was asked up front when I signed, can you make it a trilogy instead of a quartet? And I just said yes. that wasn't a problem. I had pretty vague synopsis, I've got to say, for books 2 and 3 and 4 anyway, so I just sort of squished them together. And I figured I could do it. I'd been writing. I knew I could write in the time. It was all coming together. And then, yeah, I did have my second child. Put a few limits on it, but I'd actually learned a lot in the time that I'd been away from publishing. And, like, for instance, after my PhD, I sort of collapsed for a while into a world of online RPG, which you wouldn't think would be productive, but actually it taught me to write drafts a lot faster, which was really beneficial. I did have to ask for extensions a couple of times with the Creature Court trilogy, which really affected my sense of pride because I'd always really prided myself on, you know, hitting deadlines, even really stupid deadlines, and always, you know, getting my stuff in on time. And I'd always been good at that side of things. So it was quite confronting to me to say, actually, right now, with the baby, I'm not going to quite make. And really the problem was that the second book required a second, an extra edit that nobody had sort of factored in time-wise. And my problem was I had to keep stopping writing the third book to re-edit the second one because the second one had quite a few structural problems. And I was given the wrong editor up front, basically, for the second book. Yeah, they couldn't give me the one that I'd had for the first book, Nicola O'Shea, who was brilliant, and she was busy, because, you know, brilliant editors are always busy. So they gave me a different editor, who I think didn't quite get my stuff, and, you know, it was an okay job, and I tried to do it, and then it was sent to Nicola for the copy edit, and she was like, no, this needs another structural edit. And so she did it for me, but then we were behind on everything. And, of course, whenever I had to do that, I had to stop writing the third book. Whenever I stopped writing the third book, it would always take me at least a month to get up the speed and momentum where I was actually writing at a productive level. And then another edit or something would come in, or a copy edit or something. I'd fall in a heap again. And that was really hard. Around about the time my first child was starting school and the new baby came. But, you know, it came together. The books didn't come out late. You know, they came out on time. There was one a year. It was all fine. And it was exciting. It felt like I was back in the game, you know, actually. You know, I'd had so much support from the small presses, but having that endorsement of the big publisher and an actual advance and the level of distribution that they could offer was... it was very exciting. And now I'm sort of at the other end of that and waiting for the next thing to kind of come my way. So again, you know, peaks and dips in secrets. But it was very exciting to have it out. And after the disaster that had happened with the third book, with the original, my first trilogy, I've got to say, there's something really awesome about having the whole trilogy out there on the shelf. I was a little bit superstitious about the third book. So that was lovely. And 3 books, you know, another 3 books out there. All of a sudden I'd gone from having, you know, my 2 novels and my small press stuff and 1 children's novel, and then suddenly I had another 3 books out. And suddenly, it was quite a long 3 years. A lot happened in that time. Very positive critical response. Unfortunately, it also came out at a time when bookshops were collapsing from one end of the country to another. So sadly, the sales numbers are not very happy-making. But then, as I said, it was the period when we lost Red Group, we lost Angus and Robertson, so many bookshops that Harper Voyager in particular really relied on for their distribution literally disappeared. And it was quite a... you know, tumbleweeds came through town. It was quite a scary time for writers. It still is, in a way. It's quite a... we're still kind of... it's like we're on several cliff edges trying to figure out which way to jump so as to catch the right breeze.
On your Creature Court trilogy, it's obviously infused with your love of the classics. But aside from a very clear Roman influence, it struck me as particularly... like darkly original, sort of a bacchanalian urban fantasy that somehow managed to weave politics and magic and sex with 3 women owning a dress shop. And I wondered, how important was it for you to present Valerie, Delphine and Rianne in the way that you did?
Oh, they were absolutely the core of the book. I think partly it came about because I don't know if it was partly it was me. There was a conversation about or something that I'd been working through in some of my other work and just my thoughts and my this idea of it's really the Buffy story of having to be a superhero, but then how do you actually support yourself? And I'd heard a lot of people talking about fantasy and how a lot of fantasy heroes don't have jobs, like their job is to be the hero. But what about the ordinary working people? What about the middle classes and all that sort of thing? And so really mine was a way of taking the idea of, well, also think of like Buffy again, part of what allowed Buffy to have that weird life where she fought monsters every night and then she'd go to school the next day, but, you know, she didn't really pay a lot of attention in school. She got away with a lot of that stuff. Was really because she was a teenager, and part of me thought, well, what if that kind of chosen one thing fell on somebody when they're older? If you're in your late 20s and you're established and you've got a job and you've got a house and you've got a social life and friends who, you know, this normality, and how do you equate that with having to save the world every night? And so, yeah, the friendship was really important because I wanted the reality to be, is, you know, it's the story of somebody caught between two worlds, and I really wanted the reality to be something that was important and was very tangible. And it was those sort of friends that you have, I guess, where the friendship becomes your family, because none of the women in question had all lost their family. And quite late, actually, in the drafting process was when I realised that they actually had quite literally lost their families and their memory, and that whole layer was actually quite a late addition, and suddenly all the characters made so much more sense. But basically three women who have become each other's family and they're so dependent on each other for friendship, and suddenly one of them goes off to be a superhero, which is frankly quite irresponsible. But other elements is too, like the way that friendship dynamics can settle in, and so you have the wild one and you have the sensible one, and what do you do when the sensible one is the one who decides to run off to be a superhero? And everybody is looking at her strangely because she's supposed to be the sensible one. A lot of things came together, but the other thing is female friendship. You know, female friendship stories, I don't think there's enough of them in epic fantasy or even in urban fantasy. A lot of the urban fantasy that I see that I enjoy and has really interesting female characters, a lot of it doesn't have the interesting, or didn't at the time. I'm going to say this is a while ago, and a lot of urban fantasy has made up for this in the meantime. But, like, Anita Blake was the first urban fantasy heroine that I really read. And she had these fascinating relationships with all manner of different creatures and men. But she really didn't like women very much. And she was always, she had these horrible, weird friendships that were so distant. And it felt like that she just couldn't have healthy relationships or friendships with other women. And that was always something that struck me as being a real shame. So, yeah, female friendship. And it's the whole Bechdel test thing, you know, actually having women who talk to each other and their story is important and their relationship with each other is important, regardless of romances and all that. So there were plenty of romances in the story and plenty of sex, and the two were not necessarily happening at the same time. But I wanted the most important relationship to be the friendship between those women and how it was put under incredible pressure, along with all the other weird friendships and relationships. And really a lot of the more loving and close and interesting relationships in the book were between people who weren't necessarily being romantic with each other. So there were some sort of really odd sibling-y relationships. And honorary finding your own family. There was an awful lot of family construction from poor, damaged orphan people in those books. Oh, it's such a long time since I've talked about them. I'm feeling all fond again.
You have to go back and read them.
I will. Yeah. I will. I have thought about it. I've thought of, you know, maybe writing some short stuff in that world. And I thought, well, it's been a while. I'd have to go and reread all the books. And it's quite confronting to read your books, especially once they've been published and you can't change the typos. One of the projects I've been doing this year has been getting my early novels, the Splash Dance and the others, ready to be published, reprinted as ebooks. so confronting to read something that you know was in print 10 years ago and going through and realizing, oh, yeah, so that was actually quite lightly edited then. I remember going through hell and back to edit this book, and yet I'm still, like, repeating these words in the wrong places and, yeah, going through trying not to change everything because that would be, you know, if you're trying to reprint, it's effectively my juvenilia. You know, these are the books that I first did, and I've got to keep them authentic. But I do feel I'm within my rights to correct all the typos, the really, really bad, like, writing things. And every now and then I'll quietly excise a joke that I really don't think is funny anymore, and I really don't think I should have thought was funny when I was 18. So I sort of, I tried to use that very lightly, but there were a few that I just couldn't let go, you know? Because, yeah. It's very confronting to read a novel that you wrote when you were 18 or 19. Far more confronting if it was published, gotta say. Like, I'm sure a lot of people wrote novels in their teens that are under their beds and maybe they should stay there.
Yeah.
So, it's harder. So, hopefully the more recent work is a little bit closer to who I am now and I'd feel less cringy reading the Creature Court books, because I loved writing them. I love spending time with those characters so much. I do want to be able to just put my feet up and read them and immerse myself in that world again, and maybe look at actually doing the thing I didn't have time to do at the time and wanted to, which was writing spin-off stories and a few bits and pieces from that world, because I love it very much. And by the end of the books, I'd sort of done some serious damage. Yeah, I left a few little trapdoors in it in case I want to come back and actually write serious books in that universe again. But, yeah, I think it's best we have a bit of distance for a while. But I miss the characters. I love them so much.
No, it was, I must admit, it was, like I said, it was, I found it very original. And I probably the only person I can think of that writes similar sort of friendship relationships that I've had a chance to read would be Kate Elliott, her Spirit Walker trilogy is the only time where I've sort of come up where you've got, you know, strong female friendships where they're not trying to stab in each other in the back over a man. So,
well, I will certainly take that comparison because I love her work. I've discovered her work very recently. I only started reading her probably last year. And I've only read, like you, I've been reading the Spirit Walker series. I haven't got to the end of it yet. I'm in the middle of the second one. But I'm really looking forward to going back and reading her earlier stuff as well, because I like her. I like her priorities in fiction, you know, the choices she makes. And that sounds very kind of, not mercenary, but you know what I mean? It sounds very sort of cold, but I don't know, I like her priorities. I like the kinds of stories she wants to tell, and they do seem to be very different different to a lot of the other fantasy I see. So I have no... I'm very flattered to be spoken of in the same breath, because she's a much long... She's much further down here. She has a lot more books on her belt, and I would very much love to be, you know, at that stage. So that's pretty much what I'm aiming for.
Okay.
If I can let myself let my books out into the world.
Fair enough. I was going to say, going back to your most recent works, you've released through 12th Planet Press Love and Roman Punk in their 12th Planet series, and most recently A Trifle Dead, and it's A Trifle Dead that I wanted to speak about. It's your foray into crime, and I wonder what was behind that sort of that change of genres.
Well, I didn't actually change genres. It's just that I've never had crime published before. I first wrote a version of this particular book, which was nothing like the book that it is now, but the very, very first iteration of these characters and this attempt to write crime, I wrote before Splash Dance Silver. I actually wrote the first Tabitha Darling crime novel, which was dreadful, but I wrote it for my creative writing course when I was at college. I was supposed to write something about the length of a chapter, and I did for my creative writing course. And I did that in the middle of the year. So then I wrote the rest of the book, because that's the sort of thing I was doing when I was 17. And it was terrible, and I went back and rewrote it several times, and it took on about four different plots at various stages. I wrote it again in probably the early 2000s, and that's probably the close, it was getting a little bit closer to when it is now. And every now and then I would write it, and then something happened, and I would abandon it. So yeah, I've always loved crime. I've always read crime. I mean, really interesting. I was always planning to have several writing careers. So, of course, I was going to be writing crime as well as fantasy. It's just that I didn't have the same level of momentum with crime, probably because I didn't know. Like, I fell in very early with the science fiction fantasy community, and so I directed all my energies in that direction. And so the crime quite literally fell by the wayside. And this particular book had a few, you know, close to publication along the way, and then things not working out, and then I'd get distracted by my other strands of career. And it was when it didn't feel like the book was cursed, but I was probably about, you know, very close to feeling that way about it. I had very mixed feelings about the book, and Elisa pretty much had to prize it out of my cold, dead fingers to take it away from me, because I'd got to the point where I just didn't. Now, you can get to a point where you just have gone cold from a project and you don't have faith in it. It's not necessarily anything to do with the book itself. It's more the circumstances. And she basically took it away from me. And she loved it and cared for it. And that was what it needed. And finally, it has found a home, and it's been reworked again. And it seemed to come out at the right time, which is odd because it's such a long time in the making and the talking about, but it was a good time for me to be doing something different, and it feels like I've refreshed something, especially after Creature Court. I didn't really realize, you know, because again, in my head, I want to be the sort of writer who puts out a book or two every year and just keeps doing that, and I didn't realize how much such a big trilogy would take out of me energy-wise, but it really did, because it was such an enormous work, like a whole trilogy. Very long books, not as long as Glenda Lark's, but quite long. And I sort of almost fell in a heap at the end, except then I had a grant to write the Nancy Napoleon book, so I did that next, again, to a deadline. And then I kind of fell over in a heap, and I never really got a chance to recover. So this has kind of been my way of rejuvenating myself, doing something different, just thinking about a different genre. And not just in the sense of producing the book, which, of course, is a big part of it, but also thinking about how to market that book and how to find this other community which exists, this whole crime community, which is massive in Australia. But I didn't know, you know, I didn't know this stuff was going on. Sisters in Crime is the most extraordinary organisation. I mean, these women are just, like, massive fans of the genre. And every time any female crime writer comes to Australia, they basically kidnap her and take her to tea. That's kind of their reason for living. Or make her speak in front of a really big audience. And they just embraced me and brought me into their fold. And it was sort of the overwhelming kindness just sort of surprised me, and it shouldn't have, but it really did. It was like, and I'm just like, well, I've just had one book out. I think in my head, you know, you don't really start hitting any level of success until you're that mythical person who puts out a novel every year and, you know, earns a regular living and sort of has proved yourself. And it's like they didn't really need me to prove myself. They're actually quite happy with, you've got a book out and it's a crime book and you're a female author and that's enough for us to, you know, be enthusiastic about you. And it was just so nice. Uncynical crime readers are just the nicest people, and they love books so much. It sounds surprising. It sounds silly, but, oh, just the sheer enthusiasm for books. I feel sometimes like I wouldn't want to say anything against science fiction fantasy readers. I am one myself. I love us dearly. But I do feel that there is a sort of wave of, it might just be among my friends, a bit of a wave of cynicism about just how many books there are and the time, how much pressure there is to read them all. And it all just feels like a bit like work. And I go over to the crime community and they're just like, books! Books, 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 books are lovely. Books make us happy. And I'm just like, oh, I mean, they're books about horrible murders and things, but, oh, that's really sweet.
No, well, that's where I was going to go in with my next question was, As a fan and as a commentator, had you found differences between the two communities? And I was going to ask whether there's such a thing as fake Agatha Christie fans, for example.
Oh, look, I don't know if it's because I've just got a toe in the crime community and I'm really just starting, so I haven't found, maybe I just haven't found the cynical layer yet. But so far, they're just really nice. But it could be, like I said, it could be the whole thing where you're really polite to strangers and you have your best tablecloth out and, you know, you're showing your best face. But I don't know. I'm sure they have the wars between the Poirot heads and the Marple heads. I don't know. I haven't seen any of that yet. And partly I do feel like I'm still just visiting. Like I said, I haven't quite got to the stage where I said I've been embraced and welcomed in, and that's really lovely, but it's still very early days, so I don't really feel like I am immersed in the crime community in the same way that I am in science fiction and fantasy. Science fiction and fantasy, I'm just so tangled in, you know, my jeans are nailed to the floor. I'm not getting out anytime soon. So it is a very different sort of thing. I haven't found the same level of online communities and discussion in crime that you get in science fiction, which is both a good and a bad thing. Like, I'm still looking for who the good bloggers are. I still don't feel I have enough in my RSS feed, you know. I'm still looking for that. I'm still taking the baby steps. Whereas science fiction and fantasy, I've just been there so long and I'm still meeting new people and stuff, but yeah, it feels like there are more conversations happening still in science fiction and fantasy. We do like to talk. Mm. There's a lot of conversations, and that often does lead to difficult and complicated responses from conversations and fights and all the fake geek stuff and all that stuff. But I don't know, I haven't found the dirty laundry in the crime writing community yet. I'm sure it's there. I will report back in a future date. But so far, they're just all terribly nice.
I was going to say, it's well hidden in the cupboard. They've disposed of the evidence.
Yeah, well, it's Karen Warren, isn't it, who talks about how people who have, you know, it's like she says, horror writers are like plumbers. They're always the nicest people because they, you know, they deal with horrible things all the time. maybe it's that. Some of these crime writers, they're lovely and friendly and shiny and beautifully dressed, and they're writing about horrible, 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 horrible things. So, you know, I can't say anything too nasty about them because they all know about 55 different ways to kill me and hide the body.
All right, well, bringing us back around to science fiction and fantasy. I was going to, with this last question, to finish off, if your Hugo granted you the power to shape the specfic community, what would you like it to look like in the next 5 years or by the next 5 years?
Oh, wow. Well, the next 5 years, I think that there was a really nice moment in the ceremony this year, which was one of the few bits that I got to see, where Paul Cornell talked about the importance of diversity and the different voices in the community commentating on the field. And he listed some of the, you know, really important people who've been making waves, but in a good way, and kind of talking about a lot of the important issues, people like N.K. Jemisin. And said we want to have a future in science fiction fantasy in this community where, and in conventions where we say, you know, harassment is one of those things that we used to do. And it got a really good response, and it was a really nice thing. I'd love to get to a point where there are certain conversations we're just not having anymore because they're not necessary and not because they're set them under the carpet. That would be really nice. One of the things we always said about Galactic Suburbia as a podcast was we didn't want to have the Feminism 101 conversations. We didn't want to be explaining over and over and over again from first principles, which is something you often end up doing at conventions. Conventions are great, but often with panel discussions. You always start from the beginning and you never get past the first hour. And that was the idea of the podcast, was we could keep going and no one would stop us or interrupt us except each other. It would be really nice to have certain conversations that you just don't have anymore. Something that I love and I've seen lately is that there are just so many, seem to be so many more people who are so nicely trained now in spotting the bad conversations, you know, and the bad trains of thought and the really problematic gender stuff, that when somebody says something that would normally make me wince and reach for my keyboard, someone else has usually got there first to explain to them why that was a stupid thing to say, which is lovely. It sort of feels like I'm now putting my feet up and having a cup of tea and watching other people do this stuff. There are so many people out there actually doing the hard work in educating and discussing and expanding thoughts about gender and diversity and all the racial stuff, which is the stuff that I have, you know, very, very little contribution to make other than trying to listen. But it just feels like, even though there have been some really difficult conversations had over the last 5 years, some of them were really necessary and so many of them have had really productive results, even though there have been some, you know, bruises and battered confidence along the way. And I'd have no idea. I would not... I could not use that power. That would be a terrible, terrible thing. I would just make everybody agree with me, and that's probably not something that I should do magically. Because Hugos do confer magic powers, right? That's part of the deal. But I feel I shouldn't be allowed that level of power, so hopefully they've, you know, withdrawn some of that before they posted it to me. but it would be really lovely to be, I don't know, to see where we are in 5 years' time. I like to think that we have actually, we'll actually progress instead of going backwards. It'd be nice to have new conversations that aren't the same ones that you know people were having in the 70s. it's always quite depressing when you hear somebody probably say, oh, yeah, that conversation that you're having about women writing science fiction. I remember having that conversation with Joanna Ross and Judith Merrill, and you're like, ah, oh, really? And that was how many years ago? Oh, that's a bit sad. I mean, today, just today, I don't know when this podcast is going out, but today, overnight, I woke up to find there'd been several controversies happening on Twitter while I was asleep, because I'm Australian. And the amazing stories, which really wasn't that exciting in the end. It was just somebody writing about the science fiction that he didn't like, which, as it turned out, was science fiction which cheats by mixing with almost any other thing, including, you know, it says it's science fiction, but it's really a romance. It's like, yeah, people who say that have never actually read a romance novel. Trust me, Lois McMaster Bujold does not write romance novels. If she did, her characters would be happier. especially at the end of the book. Especially at the end of the book. But even all the way through the book. They would be less miserable and there wouldn't be nearly as many severed heads. Yeah. We still get these silly conversations. But it's kind of cool to see how many people now have actually learned and expanded their way of thinking about science fiction and fantasy. And will actually stop and check themselves before or immediately after they say something like, gee, female characters are really annoying, aren't they? Yeah, I have hope. I have hope. I don't have a magic wand. But, you know, I'm sure I could use my magic, Hugo, for good. I'm coming around to the idea now. Oh, there's so many things I can do with magic, Hugo. Maybe that doesn't come to play until you win another one.
Well, what we might have to do is, before you get tempted and do a Cate Blanchett on us, we might have to end it there then. I was just going to say thank you for taking so much time out of your evening to chat with us here, or to chat with me. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Tansy, and fingers crossed for extra fan Hugos or maybe a best novel in the future.
No, I have no problems with following in the footsteps of John Scalzi. I think, you know, as far as footsteps to follow in, those are probably quite good ones to try out for a while. I'll give it a go. Thanks, John. This is lovely.
No worries. I was going to say, he has great dress sense anyway.
Absolutely.